Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, executive editor of Recode.
And I'm Lauren Good, senior tech editor at The Verge.
And you're listening to Too Embarrassed to Ask, coming to you from the Vox Media Podcast Network at Google right now, actually. This is a show where we answer all of your embarrassing questions about consumer tech.
It could be anything, like, what is blockchain? Kara, what is blockchain?
I have no idea. I still don't know after we did the entire show about something.
I know. If you're curious, if you're a fintech nerd, listen to last week's episode.
Yeah, please don't.
You could ask something like, do I need a fancy new router or Wi-Fi extender if I'm going to get decent Wi-Fi in my house?
Yes.
We've talked about that a lot on this show, and we're going to talk about it in an upcoming week as well. Will Amazon's new grocery store be called Prime Foods or Whole Echo?
Oh my God,
I came up with that one myself.
So sad. You know, I just realized everything I buy is from Jeff Bezos now. I literally, like, I buy my food at Whole Foods and I buy the other stuff at Jeff Bezos. So all my money belong to Jeff Bezos.
Congratulations, no Jeff. Problem. You put together quite a profile, a nice little data profile of Kara Swisher.
Mm-hmm.
My final question is, how much has Kara Swisher missed me over the past few weeks?
Not even slightly. What? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, totally a lot.
We're hot mic'd right now.
Right, I know that.
This
I got
is live.
Not at all. I've missed you not even slightly. My children have been here all summer, and I've been enjoying my time with them.
Okay, great. Well, maybe I'll rethink going to your event.
And when
you
leave, I'll get back to your juvenile antics, all right?
Okay.
Okay, good.
All
sounds
right.
Good. We're doing a show here this week from Google, actually, but for future shows, send us your questions because we read them all. We got a ton this week on our topic. You can find us on Twitter or tweet them to us at Recode or to myself or to Lauren with the hashtag TooEmbarrassed.
And we have an email address, TooEmbarrassed@Recode.net. You can also reach us there.
Yes, exactly. Now, I said we are actually at one of Google's many sprawling buildings in Mountain View, California right now. We're broadcasting from there.
We are.
Yes.
And we're talking about virtual reality today.
We are.
We've talked about it on this show before. Mm-hmm. Almost exactly a year ago, we went to Stanford University, their human-computer interaction lab, and we talked with Jeremy Balanson, one of my former professors, about virtual reality. We did a really fun Facebook Live. That was great.
Yeah.
But we're going to talk to someone else today about
it's a big topic in Silicon Valley. One of the companies that's involved in it is Google. And it's an area that we're all very interested in. There's been a lot of investment in the concept, not just from Google, but from Apple's in it. Facebook is in it. They bought Oculus. All kinds of people are making investments in all kinds of things. So we're very excited to have Clay Bavor here with us. He's Google's Vice President of Virtual Reality. Clay, welcome to Too Embarrassed to Ask.
Thank you for having me.
So
that was a nice long rambly intro.
I know.
For those people who like to categorize podcasts and say, well, there's ones of like, you know, a bunch of guys talking and then long rambly ones. And
yes.
Then ones whispered hushed tones. We just filled the long rambly ones.
Okay, exactly. Anyway,
so
we're here to talk about VR with Clay. So let's have Clay talk about what's going on in VR. But first, talk a little bit about how you got here and how you got to Google, which has been dabbling in the area for a long time.
Yeah, it was a somewhat circuitous path. As a kid, I was lucky enough to have a computer at home. It was an LC2. It had a color monitor.
Mm-hmm.
I had Claris Works and started making kind of basic computer art when I was in elementary school. And I was just kind of obsessed with this idea that you could create pictures and images on the computer. And a little bit later, I saw the first kind of 3D renders. This was pre-Toy Story,
mm-hmm.
Really the very first 3D computer graphics. And
don't tell me you had AutoCAD, did you?
No, I had more basic, less expensive, fancy tools.
Right.
Yeah, like a Ray Dream Designer.
Okay.
I'd ask my parents to combine my birthday and Christmas and next birthday present to get a 16 megabyte memory SIM
mm-hmm.
For my computer so I could have higher resolution textures or whatever.
Quite a skilled negotiator.
And what are you trying to make? What were you painting?
I was obsessed with this idea of trying to recreate real objects in these programs and have them look real. And so, for example, I spent a week trying to recreate my dad's Walkman. In 3D, and I do renderings of them and show them to my parents and try and fool them into thinking they were seeing photographs. And just this idea that you could use a computer, and if you understood light and shadow and form well enough, you could create something that looked real. I don't know why, but I just thought it was fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of went from there. I got into photography and panoramic photography and ended up doing kind of these small, silly kind of freelance projects with 3D animation and rendering as a teenager, and always had it in the back of my mind. And then, you know, I was at Google for many years.
What were you?
I worked on ads. I helped integrate AdMob, the mobile mm-hmm. ads company. And I spent 3 or 4 years leading the product and design teams for Gmail and Google Docs and some of our kind of productivity and work-focused apps. But I had started doing some prototyping work with the very first Oculus Rift developer kit at Google.
This was at Google
and kind of.
So you see,
is this your 20% project?
My 20% project. Yeah, and at the time, it was as is usual, kind of the 120% project or whatever. Come in literally, nights and weekends, and I built this kind of weird thing that I called the teleportation robot, where you'd put on some goggles and basically wake up in another room. And what we were doing was matching your movement in one room to the movement of a robotic arm with two cameras on it in another room.
Oh, man.
And piping the video back to...
That's super crude.
Oh. It was cool.
Yeah.
It was cool. It was very strange. But enough people saw that when then the first Google Cardboard prototype showed up. Google Cardboard was that thing where you put your phone into it. It turns into kind of a basic VR headset. It occurred to people, hey, Clay should see this. And I thought it was neat, and we had 8.5 weeks to Google I/O, and we said, "Hey, we should do something with this. This is neat." And that's kind of where this all started.
So it's just your interest.
History.
And had Google made the investment in Magic Leap and other things by this time? And that Facebook had bought Oculus.
It was 2014, and a lot happened that year.
So
not sure the exact time.
Oh, yeah.
Cardboard came out a few months after the Oculus acquisition, and I'm not sure when Magic Leap happened. It was all around the same time.
Okay, talk a little bit about Google's approach to VR. I mean, it sounds like since its inception, it's something that's been kind of hacked together in a sense. I mean, your first headset was Cardboard. You've since done Daydream, which is very mobile focused. And so that's a very different experience from the heavy duty tethered headsets we've seen from some of your competitors. Talk about why Google is taking that approach.
Yeah. So I think first of all, it's not that hard to see where this all goes. Where imagine you have some glasses and you put them on and you feel like you're completely transported somewhere else. Courtside at a Warriors game or at Machu Picchu or back in maybe a moment of your life that you've recorded.
It was an episode of Black Mirror, but go ahead. And a bad one. Bad episode.
But the reality is all of the technology, we're at the very beginning of kind of the journey to that fully realized version of VR. And we thought it was important to start simple, where things were low cost, literally in our case made out of cardboard. Making use of kind of the tools and technologies already available in your life, and that gave people a way to get a glimpse of the possibility of this thing in a way that was very approachable, affordable, and simple, right? And this insight that, your smartphone with a high-resolution screen and some sensors has a lot of what you need for a basic VR experience, and you can unlock that kind of hidden power of a basic VR.
So is it to get people used to it? It's kind of, I'm aging myself, but using Pong to show what video games could do. Remember Pong? You don't.
I do remember Pong. It was amazing.
Well, it really wasn't. When you go to play it now, it's not amazing in any way.
Looking back on it, it's less amazing.
Right. But it was the first time you could interact with a television or in some computers.
I think there's an element of that, right? It's kind of a small, approachable, simple proof point of it. And I think for a lot of people, whoa, I feel like I'm there. That's cool, right? And it was a glimpse of something to come.
Right.
Do you feel like you've sacrificed quality at all in terms of the experience because it's so mobile-focused, mobile-centric right now?
Well, obviously, when you're unconstrained on power and compute and cost and so on, you can do more, right? And so we're certainly making different trade-offs than, for example, the PC systems make. And those are deliberate. With Cardboard, for example, one of the interesting things not many people know is, people asked, hey, why isn't there a head strap on it, right? Everything else has a head strap. Well, that was a very deliberate decision because when you hold it with your hands, right, you rotate not with your head but with your torso. Your torso moves much more slowly than your head. It makes it far more comfortable to use this thing when things like you hear a lot of people talking about latency in VR.
Right.
So it makes it more comfortable. So we tried to make the trade-offs to make it more accessible, more approachable, lower cost, but do that in a way that preserve the quality of the experience, the comfort, and so on. And I think we did that with cardboard, and I think we've done an even better job of that with Daydream, which is the mobile VR thing we launched last year.
Right. So talk about where it goes, because here you are starting off very simply. I see the point of why you would do it. Others are not. Others are starting rather complex. And one of the complaints, except for really geeky men, it seems, think that it's okay to wear these massive things on your head with things popping out the back in a room, in a white room with edges. It's just completely unusable for a consumer. So they're approaching it from that side. And even the new Oculus or the various Vive. They're very onerous as a system to be able to enjoy in any way, unless you're in one of these great labs where they have them.
Well, so again, I think they're making different trade-offs in the space. And there's no doubt that VR today, there's a lot of friction in it. It costs a lot. And because it's early days in it, that there's not that much to do in it yet.
Right.
And I think that's just being honest about where we are. Where this goes, I get very excited about it, where, you know, if I told you here are these glasses you can put on that can give you access to any experience you could have with sight and sound, right, that happens anywhere on the earth. It's like, that sounds great. I would love that.
Right.
Especially if you could go there with other people, right? And, you know, I hope to see some portion of the 1,000 most beautiful places on earth. I'm not going to get to them all. And so how great would it be to basically add to the set of experiences that a person can have. And so this idea that by capturing reality experiences, whether it's, you know, the best seats at a basketball game or a concert or something else that you care about, and enabling instead of one person to have access to that seat, 10,000 or a million people, I think that's super powerful and compelling and something that really gets me excited. The other is, and I think this kind of fully realized version of VR, and again, it's going to be a while to get there, but one of the other areas is capturing moments in your life, right? And if you think about what do we use our phones for, cameras for, very few of the photos we take are kind of artistically beautiful and well composed and so on. At least I'm speaking for myself, right?
Yeah, you are. We take beautiful photos.
It's possible. It's about capturing a moment, capturing a memory, and we have line of sight to kind of the first versions of VR cameras that let you record an experience, right? And I've been using these in my own life. I have two young kids, and you know, of course, you want to be present, but there are these moments. You go to the beach, right, or even just moments with young kids, where they're at a certain state and 5 seconds of breakfast, 30 seconds of breakfast, the ability to step back into those moments and almost re-experience them. It's very powerful. And that's another direction I think this goes that I think is super exciting. And then there are the obvious ones, gaming, immersive gaming, and so
sure.
on. Mm-hmm. I think that right now and today, and I think will remain for a while, a smaller, more niche
use. Gaming.
A smaller set of the population is going to be interested in kind of fully immersive
VR gaming. Oh, you could
go,
obviously, besides, let's just skip over porn right now, but the gaming or experiential kind of things is what you're talking about. One of the things that I've noticed when I've tried a lot of these things, and I've tried everything from the touching the whale one to the gaming ones to watching a full movie where you feel someone behind you. I just did one with Jon Favreau, who's working on a bunch around gnomes, or there's goblins or
no,
gnomes.
Goblins
or
and gnomes.
Whatever, something. Yeah. Little tiny creatures.
Haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah. It's cool. It
sounds great.
I don't love gnomes, but that's fine. So they're all different. That one's more for kids, and it's not scary. Like, a lot of them are scary. But one of the things you're talking about is very different, is creating complete reality in your present.
Like creating these sort of experiences like in perpetuity of
right.
the people that you know now, which is interesting because one of the companies, there's a company in LA that I did a video piece on for Recode a few months back, and they have a Tango app, actually. We're going to get to Tango in a bit. But one of the things, and they're mostly doing entertainment and marketing things, but one of the things they mentioned as an aside was that there were some people in LA who were coming in to get holograms of their children made because they wanted them sort of captured in this moment in time, which I thought was like super interesting.
That's creepy.
Wrote on my list of things to
Well, what I'm thinking about when you think about these things is you don't know where it's going to go. And I'm just thinking of a movie that I reference a lot, which was the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report. And they go to that hall where people experience, like, I won the Oscar, or, you know, all kinds of different things, or whether it was porn, or whether it was skiing, or whatever, or whether it was killing your boss, like that kind of thing. Do you imagine, I don't think we can know where it goes. We can guess in a lot of ways where these things go. How do you guys think about that? Because I know you guys have hired anthropologists. You're kind of looking at, your news lab is doing some of that, like why people want these things. What do you imagine is going to break through first of all these various things?
Yeah. I guess to start, my hope is, and my belief is, that it's going to be tremendously additive, right, to the human experience. What you can do, what you can see, what you can experience from. And I talked about things like the best seat at whatever you care most about, or remembering things important to you. What we're seeing on Daydream, for example, is that people love going places.
Mm-hmm.
Experiential. People love seeing stuff, experiencing stuff that's hard to get access to. And that could be the other side of the world, or one of my very favorite VR pieces by Felix and Paul. They did basically a guided tour of the White House, a place that most people won't go, given by Barack and Michelle Obama. Mm-hmm. And you sit 5 feet from Obama, and it's a very compelling experience.
Mm-hmm. I can think of some people who might just want to slip back into that now, if they could. I don't know,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's a great piece of VR. It's a great piece of VR content. And I think, is it the fully realized version of VR? No, not yet. But I think you can see glimmers of it.
Before we get into other competitors that are doing this also, what do you imagine needs to happen? Because one of the things when you're talking about that, there's, you know, I remember 20 years ago at the Media Lab in MIT was talking about haptic touch and feeling, you know, I just went to Universal and I was in a movie and they sprayed water at me when I had glasses on. But you're supposed to feel like you're at the ocean. It worked. Let me tell you, it worked for the whole crowd. Like, I was like, oh, I'm at the ocean. It didn't take much. How does that work when you think, because you've got to have the entire haptic experience when you can't just be in a visual environment. There's got to be sound environment. You've got to feel like someone's behind you. You've got to, how do you imagine that occurring if you just wear glasses?
Yeah. So,
because you can convince people of it visually, but you can't.
Every sense adds something, right? Mm-hmm. And so vision is part of it. And really the what's behind this feeling in virtual reality of being somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of my cheat sheet definition of VR, which is, right, it can take you anywhere and make you feel like you're there.
Sure.
Vision is one part of that. And by vision, it means as you move your head and move your body, the world that you see reacts to your movement in exactly the same way the real world would.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can add sound to that, right? And so there are technologies to do what's called spatializing audio, where you can make a sound or a voice appear as if it's coming from somewhere in space. Haptics, as you say, touch and feel. Once you see something, you can hear it and reach out and touch it. It makes it even more realistic.
Right, it pushes back.
And so that's right. And so, there's a whole class of experiences possible without haptics. For example, at the concert, watching a musician, you're seeing and hearing stuff. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a hands-on experience.
Well, you should have beer spilled on you, but go ahead.
Yes, very advanced haptics.
That
would be challenging. We haven't solved that one yet. And so I think you're going to have this large library of kind of sight and sound experiences, and then a smaller set of possibilities with haptics, where to start it'll be controllers and simple things pushing back on you. But how you do haptics for something like leaning on a wall in virtual reality, we have no idea.
Water.
We have no idea, right? The technologies to create those things without extreme expense don't exist. And
well, could you trick people into it? I'm just curious, because sometimes when I'm in those environments, it does trick me. I did feel like someone was near me, but they weren't.
There's a lot of VR is about illusions and mm-hmm. right, you in essence trick your senses into thinking that they're experiencing reality when they're not. And so there are tricks you can do. So, for example, you could replace the wall that feels like a brick wall with a wood wall that someone rolls in.
Right.
Okay, well, that's not a great scalable solution, but it's doable, right?
Right.
And I think you'll find installations like The Void
Game.
Is something that I'm very excited about, right? These kind of installation VR experiences where They create haptics by modeling parts of the environment, but then replacing them in VR with walls that are maybe of a different type, mm-hmm. but that line up with a physical wall.
Yeah. Like in the Stanford lab I mentioned earlier, the floor is actually a vibrating floor, mm-hmm. so that as you're experiencing VR, you can feel the sort of shakes mm-hmm. of the floor.
And
it's
That's
pretty,
right.
It can be pretty like alarming if you're not, it feels very real.
It does feel very real. I think for things like that, again, you kind of need to go to a place where it's installed. I think it's going to mm-hmm. be a long time before, you know, we have
your home
a vibrating floor in our home.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Don't put it past Kara Swisher.
I will.
I want to ask you about AR, because in addition to everything you've been doing with VR, you also have been working on something called Tango, which, for those of you who don't know, has been a thing at Google since 2013. And it is a sort of a software package, but it's also kind of a hardware specification, where you guys are working with phone makers to get really sophisticated 3D augmented reality on phones. Apple, of course, just announced something called ARKit last month, where they're doing some pretty sophisticated AR stuff, but just with the software on existing phones. Yours has been sort of more of a hardware approach. Talk a little bit about that. What do you think so far of Apple's ARKit?
Yeah, well, it's exciting, right? And first of all, I think I get a lot of questions about, like, hey, VR versus AR.
I think they're the same mm-hmm. thing.
They're different points on the same spectrum.
Right.
I think of that spectrum as, I call it immersive computing. I don't really care about the label,
yeah.
but it's this idea that you have computing and digital imagery that feels like it's there. Mm-hmm. Virtual reality, everything is computer generated. Augmented reality, you have bits and pieces of digital information overlaid on your environment. And
Multiple reality, MR is what I'm calling it. You can
there are other MRs too. There's mixed and merged reality.
Merged
too.
Reality.
So you're just adding
MR.
To the confusion.
It's just MR.
There are many.
Right.
And so I see them as close related, and it's the reason we've been doing work at kind of all places in the spectrum,
yeah.
from VR first with Cardboard and then Daydream and AR with Tango. And So Tango started in 2013, and we had the first kind of mobile AR developer kit out in 2014. And the insight was, you can use mobile sensors, right? Cameras on mobile phones, the sensors that give your phone a sense of orientation.
Mm-hmm.
You can use cheap consumer-grade sensors to do pretty sophisticated sensing things, like tracking where the phone is in space, which lets you do things like place an object convincingly, you know, on the ground and have it feel like it's really there, or give you directions through a building, things like that. And so I think what's exciting about ARKit is not so much the ARKit software itself, right? That those techniques have been around for a while, and they've been running on Tango phones for a couple years. It's the scale of the Apple ecosystem, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the developer pull and interest that creates. And we've been thinking about investing in this space, for years now, and having more people thinking about building for immersive computing, whether it's AR, whether it's VR, I think is a great thing and something I'm excited about. So I think it's really interesting.
But right now, for example, I used the Lenovo Fab 2 Pro smartphone that had to have, I think, four different types of cameras or sensor sets in it, including an IR sensor, a depth sensor, a camera sensor, and all of that. I mean, are you thinking about doing some type of solution that wouldn't require all of those sensors to be in a smartphone?
I think scale's really important. Developers build where, right, a lot of people can use their software, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think overnight, not every phone is going to have some of these more advanced sensors in it. And so I think there are paths to having far more devices than just those with the dedicated sensors have it running things like Tango. And so that's something we're excited about.
Mm-hmm. And when you think about AR, what do you think the biggest applications are? One of the ones you had which caused a lot of sensation and then sort of went somewhere, was Google Glass, which is now sort of back, apparently. A lot of people were fascinated by it and then quickly discouraged by it. And I always thought that it was super unattractive. It didn't work really well. It was super glitchy. I had a line. I kept saying that it renders supermodels unattractive. You know, it just the whole thing wasn't a great experience. Is it back? Are you working on it? Are you using it? Or is it just an idea that doesn't – the idea – you said glasses several times.
Yeah. Glass, I think you're referring to Glass Enterprise Edition, right? There's some news earlier this week about that. So that's actually run from the Google X team, right?
Mm-hmm.
So part of the Alphabet family, but not mm-hmm. part of my team. And I think what they're doing there is smart, in a recognition of where glass found
people in
kind
the
of
field.
Fit, right? People have found it really useful. I think glass, the idea and the kind of fully realized vision of immersive computing, glasses, and AR, I obviously agree with that.
Right.
think it was a bit early for its time, I think, and it was not yet broadly useful, right? But for someone like a physician where they need to see patient notes and have their hands free, it's immensely useful, right? And so I think that team is clever to kind of focus on that. And I think of it not as AR, more as like a heads-up display, right, that you can use hands-free.
So
right?
What is
Do you
AR?
Think it's more like HoloLens in that way? I mean, is it competing with Microsoft and trying to, you know, attract enterprise clients?
I think the thing that distinguishes augmented reality from, for example, a companion screen that follows you around is, for me, awareness of the environment and the ability to put computing into the environment. So, Kara, you asked about, hey, what do you think the uses for AR will be? One I am so excited about is very simple, and that is navigation.
Right.
And so I spend my day in this building. I still can't find all the conference rooms, right? Mm-hmm. And so imagine that your phone, you know, you could just look through your phone, your next meeting is over there. Or you get out of a taxi, right, mm-hmm. or an Uber, and it's like, where am I? You're disoriented. It'd be nice if your phone was just, you're going over there.
Right.
And
without having
overlay,
to call up the map.
Overlay footsteps, right, on the ground, right, leading the way for you.
Microsoft made a video years ago. Did you ever see it where they do that? Where they were imagining that? I'll send it to you.
I didn't, but it's a good idea.
It's fascinating.
It's a good idea.
And then someone did a joke version of it, which was funnier, but it was an overlay of foot. Like, this is the way you go.
It's a good idea, and that will be a thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it'll be helpful. Instead of, you know, getting out of the cabin, trying to make sense of our blue dot on the overhead map and, you know, waving our phone to calibrate the compass and so on. I would say you're going over there.
We do shift our lives for you people. Like, we do all kinds of weird and unfortunate things.
What do you mean we shift our lives?
Meaning, I was thinking about that today. I was using the map, and I'm like, what the hell way does this go? Why is it not just orienting to me? It was and I was thinking, these friggin' Google people have me doing what they want me to do versus I had a little moment.
So I think AR could.
You're in the right place.
I know that. I'm complaining about that. I have to call the maps people.
I think AR could help
you. Yeah, exactly. So just before we get to readers' questions, one of the things that I think is important is business. Like, Google has enormous amounts of money, and you've got your little search business that seems to be still doing rather well and paying for all this. And besides your, you know, your hoverboards and your time machines, you know, this is probably an area of great promise from a financial point of view. How much pressure is on you to make money at it? Or you can see there's money to be made here. This is something that you can actually see a path towards businesses and all kinds of content businesses hanging off of it. When do you imagine that happens? Like, there's devices, there's content, there's subscriptions, all kinds of things that could happen. How do you look at this as a business?
Well, to start, we're doing, I think, what Google generally does, which is start with figuring out what is the product and user experience and building something that's useful to users and mm-hmm. trying to figure out how should this work, how can we do a useful job for our users, and kind of assume that if we can do something valuable, delightful, fun, that kind of the business models and monetization opportunities follow. Mm-hmm. And I think there's some near-term things that we have line of sight to. For example, you know, we see huge interest in again, kind of VR video and YouTube VR. Mm-hmm. Because, again, it's fun to go places. It's fun to go to Coachella if you can't make it to Coachella, or to, you know, travel to the other side of the world with Street View. And you can imagine kind of VR ads where you could go inside the showroom for a new car or, mm-hmm. or whatever. And so I think that's a very, very natural extension. What I'll say is we're very much in the figuring it out and getting it right phase. And the product, the technology, the user experiences. And while I think it's useful to keep an eye on the business models and how those will play out, it's not our focus right now. It's the technology, and most importantly, the use cases, the jobs we're doing for users, right? Taking them to the other side of the world to see something they care about and things like that.
And do you imagine you need help from Hollywood and others? Because not to say that Google people are not creative, but Google people are not creative in that way. You know what I mean? How do you partner with people who are actually... Because to me, one of the problems with Hollywood is that there's a lot of people who can make movies or TV shows, but this is a whole other class of content creatives. Do you know that it's totally a different thinking?
I absolutely
and that's
agree.
Why I went and interviewed John Favreau agree. Because he's sort of thinking that way, and even he has a hard time with it. And he's obviously
like distribution is changing so much. There even you know there are some producers that still don't necessarily want to work with just the basic streaming platforms because of the way it's shifted the economics. So when you talk about something like
this
now, let's make content
level.
For VR. That's a whole different area of distribution
and thinking and
to
creativity.
Heads.
Yeah. Right.
The so Sir John Hegarty of. Is it BBH, one of the big UK-based advertising agencies, had this great quote. He said, technology creates possibility, creativity creates value.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think of a lot of the job we're doing is solving some of the hard technical problems from how do you capture reality in a way that you can kind of represent it in another place in virtual reality or the glasses, the hardware that actually makes the stuff possible. But absolutely, the artistry, the content, the storytelling, the narratives, the content, the IP, the characters that you connect with, it's so important. And the a headset or an operating system or anything without the experiences, the content, the art in it, it's not
so
a value.
So who's going to do
it's
that? Is that a value. Google thing that they're going to pay for, the way YouTube sort of tried to seed? Because, you know, you don't just get Star Wars. I mean, although George Lucas did do the special effects stuff and then used it for the story that made billions and billions and billions of dollars. Who does that? Is that Google going to have to like pay for creators to exist?
Well, I think it's a combination.
Or so, Facebook or whoever.
I think it's a combination of things. So one thing I'm really proud of that we're doing is we have we've built this system called Jump, as in enable you to jump to Paris and then the other side of the earth and Machu Picchu. And it's a camera system for capturing VR video, very high quality VR video. And we partnered with a couple companies to make these VR cameras. And we have a program called Jumpstart, which we're loaning cameras and giving processing time to students, artists, and so on to go and use these tools and see what they do. And so it's kind of enabling creative people with the tools and helping them with the technology, with the process, in some cases with money, to go and make great things and see what happens. With Tilt Brush, we had an artist in residence program where we reached out to great artists and said, hey, here's this tool. We think it's neat. What will you do with it? And people came back with some amazing things. And then I think, of course, as with any kind of medium, we'll be looking to partner with Hollywood and developers of games to bring franchises and IP and so on, you know, into VR, into AR, so that people can connect with characters and stories and stuff that they care about.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be Hollywood. That's the thing. I don't, you know what I mean? Like, we go there immediately, but it's a whole different mentality. I don't know. I think it's.
They're trying,
but it's an interesting question of who, like, because that's what's going to matter with VR. Is
I think Hollywood will matter a lot. Right. I think a direct translation of film to VR won't work, but I think a lot of the instincts for story, character, special effects, crafting alternate realities, I think that's really useful.
That's interesting.
I think in addition, you're going to have people who've been building games, right? Games are in essence VR worlds. We just didn't have the goggles to inhabit them, right? And so I think both are going to matter a lot. And I wouldn't short sell Hollywood at all in this area.
All right. In a minute, we're going to take some questions about virtual reality from our readers and listeners, and Clay is going to answer them. Is that right, Clay?
That's great. I'm excited about these.
But first, we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor, Lauren. The word, please.
Ka-ching.
Thank you.
How do you think that'll sound in like 3D sound in a VR headset?
Money will fall on your head in
That's
a
right.
haptic fashion.
Yes.
And we'll throw money in people's faces.
To build the kinds of things developers want to build today, they need better tools. That's why Amazon Web Services built Amazon Aurora. It's a relational database engine that's compatible with MySQL and PostgreSQL, and it provides up to 5 times the performance of the standard MySQL on the same hardware at a tenth of the cost. Amazon Aurora from AWS can scale up to millions of transactions per minute. It automatically grows your storage to 64 terabytes. That's a lot of terabytes. And it replicates data to 3 different availability zones. You don't have to manage a thing. There are no upfront charges, no commitments. You only pay for what you use. Check it out at aurora.aws.
We're back with Clay Bavor talking about virtual reality. And now we're going to take some questions from our readers and listeners. Lauren, do you want to read the first question?
You know I do. The first question is from Kevin Swint at KSwint on Twitter. Is the primary barrier to mass VR adoption simply the form factor of the headsets?
Hey, Kevin, thanks for the question. I think it's a bit more complicated than that. Certainly, the headsets are part of it. And I think it's important to remember that today's headsets are largely made out of components that were really meant for smartphones. So VR headsets basically contain a smartphone display, sensors from smartphones. And so it's kind of like trying to make airplanes out of bicycle and car parts, right? You can do it. It's possible. It's how the Wright brothers got started, but it's not exactly where things converge. So the headsets are part of it, but also I think we're still learning about the content and the medium and the experiences and what works and the tools needed to create those. And so I think more than just, you know, lower friction, higher resolution headsets need to come together. But the cool thing is we see progress on all these fronts, right? Figuring out what works and improving the hardware. So I think we're heading in the right direction.
Do you think that even, I'm going to ask a quick follow-up question, even if you got this engineered perfectly and it was incredibly high fidelity and a great experience, do you think people will get used to sitting, let's say, next to each other on the couch at home, both wearing headsets?
I think there are two parts there. One is getting comfortable with any technology. I think if you know you went back 20 years and you told people that everyone was going to walk around the street looking at a small glass rectangle in their hand, they might be a bit confused. And so I think getting used to it is part of it. I think even more important is there's not yet great software for enabling you to go places in VR with other people, right, in the same room. And so, you know, going to a concert is a lot more fun with friends, right? And so we aren't seeing those kind of shared experiences yet, and I think that's one of the big breakthroughs we're going to have to make.
Great. Next question. Kara, would you like to ask?
This one's from @RoanBade. Apple is betting on AR, Google on VR. Thoughts? Also, would Daydream work with iPhone someday? P.S. Kara, don't try my last name. Oh, I just did, and I failed badly.
Yeah, so great question. To start, I don't see VR and AR as these two separate things, and we talked about this a bit, but rather kind of points on the spectrum of immersive computing. And I think of what we've been doing at Google as working along this spectrum in VR with Cardboard and Daydream, and more in AR with things like Project Tango, which puts kind of augmented reality capabilities into smartphones. And you know, we've had those out for 2 or 3 years now. And so I think we're betting on immersive computing, that is going to be useful and unlock some really, really powerful tools and experiences for people in a big way. And again, where and how and when and exactly what form factor first, it's hard to say exactly, but I think we see that being very important in the future of computing, entertainment, and other things. So that's how I think about that. Daydream on the iPhone. You know, I never say never, but it's important to realize that a lot of the work that we did to make Daydream run on Android phones, to kind of VR-enable Android phones, was deep in the operating system, the core software running on the phone. And of course, we're not able to work on the iPhone operating system on iOS. And so barring some pretty major changes there or some other unforeseen thing, I think it's pretty unlikely that Daydream is going to be on the iPhone.
Okay. Next question is from @ZDuBoss. #TooEmbarrassed. What's happening with the standalone Daydream headsets? Will they be comparable to the Vive or Rift? Are you going to tether Daydream headsets?
Yeah, so at Google I.O., which is our developer conference back in May, we announced what we call standalone VR headsets for Daydream. And that just means that rather than having to hook your VR headset up to a PC or put a smartphone in it, everything that you need for VR is there. So the displays, but also kind of the computing, the graphics processor, and so on, all in these goggles. And so those will be rolling out. The first of those will be on sale later this year. And you know, no specific updates there right now, but later this year. And they won't be compatible with, they won't be comparable to the Vive and Rift, and that you won't have to plug them into things, right? And so that's very different. You know, of course, they're not relying on a big beefy PC for power and compute and so on. And so the experiences that are going to be possible, and they're going to be a bit different. But we see some very, very compelling things, and we're excited about just how much easier these things are going to be by being self-contained. You pick it up, you put it on, you're in VR. We're looking forward to that.
So there's lots of questions about nausea and dizziness. This one is from Maria Petrova. What's the part of the brain that causes dizziness from VR? Motor cortex, question mark. Do universities and hospitals actually use it for surgery? Next one, Todd Heberlein. Does Google recommend frequent breaks from VR? If so, how frequently? Dr. Baver, you need to tell us. Any evidence that hurts VR's appeal to hardcore gamers? And then Michael Welch asks, ask them what the worst, funniest incident of motion sickness from VR they have ever seen or heard. So, Clay, have you thrown up? I think that's really the question there.
It's quite a set of questions, very exciting set of questions. The first one, so what can cause discomfort in VR, motion sickness or feeling a bit off? VR done well shouldn't do that, and by and large doesn't do that. But when it's off, what's happening is what you see, your vision, disagrees with what your head feels, and in particular, what your inner ear senses. And so there's this weird thing in your inner ear, which is basically a kind of biological orientation sensor. It's what lets us keep our heads level with the horizon and gives us our sense of balance and so on. And our brain is used to, as we move our head, you experience the orientation change of your head through your inner ear, and your vision, what you see through your eyes, agrees with that. When those two don't agree, so for example, if in VR you turned the scene without the person turning their head, those two senses would disagree, and that's what causes the discomfort. And so, again, done right, VR doesn't do that, and that's one of the things we've been working hard on. Things like what we call tracking, where the head, we track the position of the head and make sure that the imagery lines up perfectly with how you're moving. So let's see, the other ones, what have we seen? The worst, funniest incident? Well, I'd say
the frequent breaks, actually. Do you recommend people take breaks from VR?
Oh, I think mostly it's listen to your body, right? Listen to how you feel, and if you feel off, okay, you know, take a break, just as you take a break if you're watching TV for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm. But there's no mechanism in a daydream or anything that Google's doing right now that will say, okay, it's been an hour.
Not that I know of. Okay. Not that I know of, no. And then worst, funniest incident, I can tell you one really interesting thing we see is in an experience that we put people through if they're kind of seeing VR for the first time. We call it the diving board. And it's very simple. You put on goggles, and remember, you're just kind of in a conference room or an office building in Mountain View generally. You put on goggles and you're poolside. And it's very clearly not a real pool. You look down at the ground and it kind of is made of these white rectangles. And you look to your right and there's a diving board. And you look up, and there's an even taller diving board. And you look up some more, and there's an even taller diving board. And I think the tallest one is 50 meters up. And so we push a button, and you're kind of teleported to the top of this 50-meter-tall diving board. And what happens next is amazing. So people, they duck down. They lower their center of gravity. And apparently we've evolved to, if we find ourselves, you know, on the face of a cliff, to lower our center of gravity so we don't fall off. People will reach for hand railings that aren't really there. And once they kind of get their bearings, they stand up, and then we say, great, so could you please go to the end of the diving board and take a step off? You know, remember, you're just in a conference room in Mountain View. Everything's fine. People kind of inch out. They get to the end, and they look over, and most people can't step off. Most people can't do it. Knowing full well that it's not real, having the imagery clearly be not real, they can't do it. And I think it just speaks to, right, the power of VR to really make you feel like you're somewhere else. And so those are some of the kind of funniest, most interesting experiences I've seen. You know, fortunately, we haven't had anything more dramatic than not being able to jump off the diving board.
I kind of felt my stomach drop a little bit as you were telling that story. So, and I've had a couple of experiences like that in VR, but we'll save that for another podcast. This question's from Alex Hardy, who's written in before. Thanks, Alex, at Can't Hardly Wait on Twitter. What's the next billion-dollar VR use case, and what's the next billion-dollar VR company?
Well, the first thing I'd say is I think we're still looking for the first billion-dollar use case and the first, maybe the second after Oculus, billion-dollar VR company. One of the use cases I think is just going to be so powerful and ubiquitous because everyone cares about something, a team, a sports team, an artist, a place. is this idea of taking you other places, kind of teleportation with VR to other places around the world. And so I think that's very promising as one of these big billion-dollar use cases. Next billion-dollar VR company, I have no idea. I have no idea. What I can say is I think there is so much potential in this space, right, where you can put on some goggles and really feel like you're somewhere else, whether that's someplace real, someplace created, something artistically beautiful, something you care about, something you're learning about. And so I don't know what the next one will be, but I'm sure that there are going to be many of them, you know, over the next decade.
Next question is from Sandy Ressler, S. Ressler, who asks, any plan to support more capabilities to live in VR environment, to do daily work, typing well, editing docs, etc.? Similar question from Gummy Joe, I hope I pronounced that correctly. What actual use cases does he see for VR in general, other than fun and games in the next 5 years, like in the professional field?
Yeah, on Sandy's question on typing, editing documents, and so on, I think our computers do a good job of that now. And what I always look for in VR, what are things that you can only do in VR, uniquely do in VR, as opposed to things that you can also do in VR? And so I think you could do that. Should you? And is it better than using a laptop or a tablet? I'm not sure. And so I don't see that being a big use case in the near term. And that's partly because our existing tools do that well, and secondly because you, for example, need a lot more screen resolution in VR than we have today. On the second one, what use cases do I see beyond fun and games, like in the professional field? We already see glimmers of this in an application that we've actually built called Expeditions. It's a tool for teachers to take classes on virtual field trips to anywhere. That's kind of the virtual reality version of it. And a few months ago, we announced an augmented reality version of it where you can bring any object, the Statue of David, a model of the Colosseum in Rome, into the classroom. And it turns out that virtual and augmented reality, immersive computing is a tool for teaching, is a really powerful tool. And I see that extending into the professional fields in things like training and simulation. And I think VR will be pretty important and valuable in that space.
It's probably a good segue to the next question from Peg Achterman, who says, I'm just beginning to teach some VR to college journalism classes. Suggestions for good use in stories. You mentioned an educational use case, but I guess what's a good example? I'm curious about this too. I don't know, a good story would be for someone to explore VR as a storytelling possibility.
Well, I think great journalism helps explain what's going on, how to think about something. Great journalism can also help you imagine what's going on in another place, kind of help take you there, describe the setting, describe the scene, and so on. And I think it's in that second one where VR can be especially helpful. I think there's a big difference between, you know, reading about a place or actually having a glimpse of what it's like to physically be there. And I think we see news outlets using VR to do exactly that, right? Put you alongside combat troops, right? For example, that's what it's like. Or to put you in the middle of parades or festivals or protests. And I think that's where I would focus if I were using VR for journalism, taking people places, helping them fully get what it's like to be there.
Mm-hmm. At The Verge, we did a 360 video at one point of Michelle Obama, and it was fantastic. But the one thing I will say based on our experience with it is it's very production intensive. It's not kind of like a, let's just, you know, grab our DSLR and run out there and shoot something quickly. It takes a lot. It takes a lot to edit as well.
We're working on making that easier.
Oh, good.
With great companies that make some great tools.
Great. Kara, do you want to ask the last question?
From Edward Vero, here's my question. Do you believe VR can be the drug of the future due to psychological addiction? So, Clay, are you a drug dealer?
Well, I think about this like I think about our phones or TV. Our phones are engaging. TV is engaging. I think VR has the potential to be engaging and entertaining and amusing and in, you know, very similar ways to our phones or our TVs. And so do I see it somehow being qualitatively different from those? I'm not sure I do, right? And I think you'll have people that use VR for really useful things. You'll have people that use VR for entertainment. And I think just as our phones or our TVs are engaging, it'll be engaging too, right? And will we have people who use VR a lot? Probably, right? But I see that as no different from, you know, do we all use our phones a lot?
But you're also promising that it'll be more immersive than that. The promise of VR is that it gives you a more realistic or immersive, engaging experience, right? So I guess if you're impacting, I don't know, the human emotions or cognitive development in a greater way.
I agree. The sense of immersion and presence and the kind of richness of the sensory experience, that's absolutely the promise of VR. I think we have some work to do, right, before we fully realize that goal.
This has been another great episode of Too Embarrassed to Ask. Clay, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you all enjoyed this week's episode as much as we did, be sure to subscribe to the show. And you can also leave us a review. Go to iTunes.com/Too Embarrassed to Ask. And we really do read all of your reviews.
We don't. I don't at all. But Lauren does. But seriously, subscribe. If you do, you'll be the first to listen to new episodes every Friday or catch up on previous episodes where we answer all of the tech questions that our listeners have been too embarrassed to ask.
Yes. And you can also subscribe on Google Play Music,
right,
TuneIn, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or you can just go to the website. Go to recode.net/podcasts.
Yes. And while you're there, you should check out our other podcasts like Recode Decode, Recode Replay, and Recode Media with Peter Kafka.
The Verge also has a great podcast. It's our flagship called The Vergecast, hosted by Nilay Patel.
Don't forget to tweet your questions ahead of time to @Recode with the hashtag TooEmbarrassed or email them to TooEmbarrassed@Recode.net.
Thanks for listening. And thanks also to Digital Media, the company that distributes this show, including Beth O'Connell and our editor, Chris Basil. And thank you to our producer, Eric Johnson, who has not removed his VR headset since approximately 2013. He's wearing it right now. We'll be back next week to answer more of the questions you've been too embarrassed to ask, so tune in then.